Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Jeff.
On today's show, we remember Joe Christopher and we remember 2023. But first, this show is being recorded on Tuesday at 1 o'clock and dropped at Thursday, 1 a.m. We did the same thing last week, Tuesday, 1 p.m., Thursday, 1 a.m. It's the off season. What could happen? Well, a lot happened. Therefore, much of the show was outdated by the time you heard it. It still was spectacular, but some of it was outdated. And one of the things that was outdated was Billy Epler's job status. I mentioned that he was still on the org chart, and he was there, and he could show David Stearns where the copier was and where the coffee machine was. By Thursday, he had voluntarily resigned, Greg.
Yeah, vaya con Dios, Señor Epler. Yeah, Billy Epler was going to be a big part of the David Stearns regime. Everybody was on board, and then in a matter of hours after we clicked stop, he was gone. Which was very surprising to not only bystanders like Jeff and myself, but the entire baseball cognoscenti seemed taken aback by this. There had been no leak or anything that said, well, watch out for Epler leaving. And then a few hours after that, word was that Epler was under investigation by MLB for some sort of shenanigans involving the injured list. And that was why he was heading out a side door without one of those big thank you, Billy, types of graphics from the Mets. I don't know. And hey, listen, any part here where I sound like I know what I'm talking about is accidental, because I don't know anything more than anybody else has read. But it seems kind of strange, even if there is an investigation into using the injured list improperly, that that would send your general manager out the door. He had said, I want to give David a clean slate. I don't know if there's a combination of things working there, that maybe Epler wasn't all that thrilled to be working under Stearns, or maybe this is more serious than it looks. Maybe there's more to it than just, hey, they put the guy with back spasms who didn't have back spasms on the injured list, which is always kind of what we say after somebody has a terrible relief outing. Well, we guess he's going on the injured list now. And sure enough, the next day, a roster spot magically opens for the next relief pitcher up from Syracuse. So you can kind of infer what you want, I suppose. Or you can take it all at face value. Billy Epler said he wanted to do David Stearns the courtesy of stepping aside. And then this other thing came out about the injured list, and maybe that's the reason. Either way, there's another slot to fill on the Mets org chart, as Jeff called it. And perhaps there'll be a press conference at some point, much like there will be a press conference for a new manager. My guess, just a guess, is that the managerial search probably takes precedence, because it's going to be Stearns' call anyway. And having somebody to serve as general manager or some like title will come after that as the offseason begins to get going. And, you know, listen, Billy Epler one minute was running baseball operations, and it was very important that we had Billy Epler here or in that job. And now somebody else is running baseball operations, and I don't want to dismiss Billy Epler's role in the Mets organization as it was intended to be, but, you know, it's not like there's a vacancy at the top. You know, that's what Stearns is here for. Again, Stearns is job is more than just general manager, but I think he's probably has that covered, or at least in the interim. It's not like 2 years ago before Epler and after the two general managers who proved both temporary and interim, there was this sense of the Mets don't have anybody and nobody wants to work for the Mets. Look at all the people who were turning down Steve Cohen, and then suddenly Epler was here, and it was like, oh, okay, it just took an extra couple of weeks. So, Epler did a job for 2 years that I don't think we're going to know exactly how great it was or how not great it was until the trades that he made at this trade deadline pan out or don't pan out. That will probably ultimately be his legacy to the Mets. I mean, let's not forget, he comes in, he is Steve Cohen's personal shopper, and he signs four impact free agents the first weekend. Again, they had to rush because there was a lockout coming, but those were defining. Going out and getting Escobar, Marte, Canha, and ultimately Scherzer comes out of the lockout, signs Ottavino, trades for Bassett, and the tone was set for a fantastic 2022 regular season. The trade deadline after that in 2022 wasn't as spectacular. The July of Vogelback and Ruff and Naquin, and a promising offseason after that, Verlander and Senga, and bringing back Nimmo. Again, a lot of this is a matter of Steve Cohn's wherewithal and resources, but somebody had to do negotiating, somebody had to oversee the scouting and the decision making. So some worked, some didn't. I think you'd say that about every general manager in every franchise. So I don't want to seem, I don't know how to seem exactly, honestly. It's easy to take shots when you remember that, hey, wasn't this the guy who not only brought in Daniel Vogelback, but a story emerged right before he left that he's the one who wanted Daniel Vogelback in the lineup all the time. Let's not make it all about Daniel Vogelback. We fans are horrible that way. We always pick like the most obviously fragile member of the herd and stomp on them. So, Billy Epler did more than be a Daniel Vogelback advocate, is what I'm saying. Good luck to the guy. I hope he didn't do anything wrong, or if he did it wrong, I hope it doesn't implode on him personally. Although, to be honest, I don't know him, so I don't know why I'm worried about what happens to him, other than trying to be a decent human being towards somebody who worked for the Mets.
We hope that his legacy doesn't involve costing the Mets draft picks. A lot of the reporting we've read expressed surprise that IL manipulation is the charge and suspects that maybe there's more to it than that. Let's hope not, and that it doesn't cost the Mets any precious draft picks. Something else we talked about last week were the Miami Marlins, and I went on a slight rant about the Marlins' petulant behavior during the last week of the season regarding rainouts and the ground crew. And I said definitively I would root against them throughout the playoffs. Well, by the time you heard the episode, they were gone. I was happy about that. The Marlins eliminated in two games.
It was very effective the way you got rid of them so quickly. To quote the wolf in Pulp Fiction, giving the details on what had to be taken care of, nobody will be missed at the moment.
You know what I read? That of the eight wild card game series, the best of threes that have been played last year and this year, that's the only two best of threes in the expanded playoff wild card era. Seven of the eight series were decided 2-0. The only one that was not was the Mets Padres series. The Mets lost 2-1. So, yay.
We are the champions of losing National League and American League wild card series. Congratulations, 2022 New York Mets.
And we also talked at length about a game Greg went to that was suspended, and it was still suspended on Tuesday, even though the game was resolved and it didn't matter for the playoff seedings. The Mets Marlins game was rained out, and the Mets were credited with a win, but it took until Wednesday for that to happen. When we spoke on Tuesday, we were incredulous, but as of Wednesday, the day after we recorded, the Mets had an extra W, and Greg was there for that game.
Yeah, I'm 8-5 for last year. I'm not 7-5-1. I'm glad we could correct that. I don't know why it took them so many days to figure this out. I understood we might have to come back here and play the last inning plus if anything's on the line. By Sunday, they knew nothing was on the line. why it took until Wednesday to say, okay, we're going to dig up that rule about team leading after the last completed inning, even though the other team took a lead in the incomplete inning. Whatever. The Mets finished the year 75-87, one game better than 74-88, a record they had had twice before. One game not as good as 76-86, a record they had had twice before. When the season is ending, I'm usually looking for a unique record. So I got that. And yeah, we didn't have to pretend it was a tie. A little disappointed that I didn't see something that was officially unprecedented. But in my heart, I know the Mets were losing as the talk went on and they never completed playing. It goes, hey, listen, I'll take the win. We'll all take the win. But I did see something unprecedented that night. It was wild. The aftermath of nothing being decided for 6 days, I guess, was unprecedented too. So I'm putting that down as one of my more memorable and bizarre baseball experiences. And I've had a few of them as a Mets fan. So congratulations, the Mets of September 28th. You did better than the 2022 Mets of the National League Wild Card Series. We have just determined.
One thing we can't change, of course, are other results from 2023. 23 was a terrible season. So, of course, National League Town is beginning its look back on the 2023 season. Why are we going to do this? Well, today we're going to talk about what went wrong. And we could go on for hours about it. I will not. But it's important for us to learn what went wrong to make us smarter fans. Maybe we won't make dopey predictions. Maybe we won't make bad bets. The Mets won't ask our opinion, but we can become smarter fans if we learn from what happened. So we begin our look back at 2023 with my view of what went wrong. And it starts with, of course, the Edwin Diaz injury. Diaz's injury was far from the only thing that hurt the Mets in 2023, but as one official put it, it may have been the biggest thing. Remember when Edwin Diaz got hurt? Of course you did. It was calamitous. He was playing for another team in a game that didn't involve the Mets, but the Mets' downward spiral began at that very moment. Edwin Diaz wasn't just the Mets' closer, he was the best closer in baseball, and no other team can say that. I remember having a discussion with a Nationals fan a few months into the season, and he said, well, the guy you have there, he didn't even know his name, the guy you have there is pitching well, so the Diaz injury didn't matter. Of course it did, I slowly explained to him. Diaz was the best closer, and Robertson was supposed to pitch the eighth inning, not the ninth inning. The Mets lost not just one player in the bullpen, they lost the best player, and it affected the entire bullpen. The Diaz injury was huge, but it was also huge because of the way Billy Epler solved it, which was he didn't do anything. At the beginning of spring training, Billy Epler said, we have five solid relievers, and the other two spots will be used by optionable relievers. And we said on this show, why not the best relievers? No, Billy Epler wanted optionable relievers to have a pipeline between Syracuse and Flushing all season long. It got to the point where I wondered why the radio booth didn't have the Mets move of the game sponsored by Allied Van Lines. Billy Epler said he was going to have two optionable relievers. Well, he had three. Now let's take a pause here. We don't know if he tried to get somebody to fill Diaz's role. A National League town, we try to look at all sides of an issue. Maybe he called up the Reds and said, we're missing a Diaz. You have a Diaz. Can we make a trade? And they said, sure, give us Alvarez, give us Mauricio. Of course, the Mets weren't going to do that. So maybe he tried. But what we do know is that he didn't get anybody, and the Mets had three optionable relievers throughout the season. And we'll see how that played out in a few minutes. It not only affected the bullpen, it came into play because of starting pitching. We talked about injuries. The Mets lost Quintana before the season started. He was supposed to be a better version of Taijuan Walker. The Mets lost Carrasco in spring training. And remember opening day? Hey, this is Gary Cohn. Welcome to opening day. Justin Verlander's on the IL. Tyler McGill is starting. What? When did that happen? So the Mets lost three of the five intended starters immediately. And that meant Peterson and McGill had to step up. and they did not. The Mets starting pitching was terrible. Remember, at one point, Gary said the Mets starters were averaging less than 5 innings a game. Who had to fill those innings? Billy Epler's bullpen with the three optionable arms. So his failure to act came into play because of the failure of the starting pitching. This is where you needed Max Scherzer to step up, and he did not. The great Tony Kornheiser calls Max Scherzer a warrior god. Warrior god, my ass. He was terrible. He embarrassed the Mets with his suspension in mid-April. He was the first player to get suspended for sticky stuff. And remember, the Mets couldn't replace him on the roster. He was the first player suspended that day in Los Angeles. Max Scherzer was terrible. I'm going back now to last September in Atlanta, last October against San Diego, and throughout this season. Yes, he had some good games. He had a good game in Colorado I went to. He had a good game in Philadelphia. He had a good game before he left against Washington. But if I can remember individual good games from Max Scherzer, it shows you he had a bad season. Farewell, sticky fingers. It wasn't just the starters, though, and it wasn't just the relievers. We have to talk about the hitting, and we have Starling Marte. His injury is an underrated factor as to why the Mets were bad this year. He was barely a presence. I was surprised to see that he played in 86 games this year. Did the Mets handle him properly last offseason, at the beginning of this season? We don't know, but his absence is important. The Mets needed him, and they will need him next year. The Mets will be counting on him. What is his status? The Mets didn't seem to know all season long. The Mets needed him this year. Let's talk about Jeff McNeil. Boy, did I think Jeff McNeil was going to have a great season. In 2022, he was the National League champion of batting. This year, he was not the champion of anything. He did not adjust to the absence of a shift. I thought he would. Now, I wonder if the WBC hurt him. He vacated the Port St. Lucie for 2 weeks and basically sat on Mark DeRosa's bench. What a waste of time. He should have been swinging the bat, and he was not good until the end of the season. Francisco Lindor had a 6 WAR, and I'm not going to complain about Francisco Lindor. 30-30 had a great season overall, but he was streaky, and it took him a while to get going. It seemed to be time to when his wife gave birth. We talk about empathy on the show. Maybe something was up there. Or maybe it was his elbow. He just had surgery. He could have had surgery during the season, but he played through it all year. That's admirable. Maybe that was the reason why he was so streaky during the season. But the Mets don't need him to be streaky. And I keep thinking about that pop-up he dropped in Philadelphia in June on a Friday night. Luis Castillo could have caught that ball. Third base, ugh. Brett Beatty had 389 plate appearances for the Mets. What did he do with them? The Mets don't know who's going to play third base next year. Brett Beatty had every chance. The Mets tried. Third base has returned to be a open question for the Mets. Let's talk about Pete Alonso. He went through long slumps. He had that injury. Did he rush back from that injury? He says no. We have to take him at his word for that. But this year, he reminded me of Dave Kingman. His offensive WAR this year went from 30.6 to 15.7. Now, he was hit 21 times, the most in the NL. What did that do to him? And he did have 46 home runs, but I think it was the absence of somebody behind him. He felt pressure to carry the load. That seems to be the type of person he is. He had no one hitting behind him. So he went weeks, it seemed, where you wondered, can he even hit the ball? Every player is going to be streaky, but he's got to be more consistent. He had 46 home runs. We love Pete. I hope the Mets sign him forever, but he needs to be more consistent. And he will be more consistent if he has somebody to hit behind him. And this is another shame of Billy Epler. For 2 years, had nobody to hit behind Pete. So maybe Pete felt he had to carry the load. That's on Billy Epler. Steve knew, and I have to point this out. Steve said that Carlos Correa was the missing piece. They did not sign the missing piece. So what did that say to the team? Maybe nothing, but Steve was right. There was at least one missing piece to the offense. Steve shouldn't have said that. So who hit behind Pete Alonso? Again, that's on Billy. And it turned out to be the aforementioned Daniel Vogelbach. And Buck put him there throughout the season. And Buck, I'm going to cut back on this section of it because Buck's gone and I don't want to pile on. But Buck handled things poorly all season long, including using, for whatever reason, it seems to be up in the air why, using Daniel Vogelbach, who barely could hit behind Pete Alonso. Buck managed game situations without urgency, and he kept playing for extra innings that didn't come. He played for tomorrow. He played for the end of the season. I remember one game, and I went to this game May 15th at Washington. It was a Monday. It was a wraparound series. And it was a Monday afternoon. We weren't sure who was going to pitch. And it turned out to be David Peterson. And Justin Verlander could have pitched. And this wasn't the David Peterson we saw at the end of the season. This was the David Peterson with an 8 or 9 ERA that was soon sent down. And I knew that the Mets were going to lose because David Peterson was starting and the Mets got clobbered. And they asked Buck why he pitched David Peterson. He said he wanted to give Verlander and Scherzer an extra day of rest. Well, how did that all that rest turn out? Did Bruce Bochy and Dusty Baker send Buck a thank you note for resting pitchers on their roster? Because that's what Buck did. Played for an end of season that did matter. And the next manager can't do that. You can't manage every game as if it's game seven, but Buck managed many games as if they were spring training. So part of this is on Buck. This team was sloppy. It's a hallmark of Buck's teams that they not be sloppy. So Buck's mismanaging was part of the reason. So Greg, injuries, failures of the players, Billy and Buck, two of the four reasons are gone. There's a lot that went wrong this year.
I'm dabbing my forehead from just reliving all of that with you and knowing how much it strained your insides to have to revisit that. Though I have to say, the Tony Kornheiser remark or your reaction to it kind of sounded in my head, "Warrior, guard my ass." Sounds like NBA trash talk. What is to say beyond the fact that 87 losses out of 162 tries attests to all that went wrong and the examples you brought up? I was walking out of the ballpark en route to the subway on the final day, and there is a guy who plays his trumpet outside on Mets Plaza, presumably for tips, perhaps just for the love of music. And his playlist is always very Mets intensive. And the song he was playing was Narco, almost as a dirge. And I began to almost get something in my eye, as they say, as I heard the lonely notes of Edwin Diaz's walk-in music. I really wish this guy had eliminated it from his playlist for the rest of the season, let alone the last game of the season. But it started that night. And you mentioned the Syracuse to Flushing pipeline. And if any pipeline needed to be flushed, it was the one that brought one quadruple A reliever after another to take on to pitch those fifth and sixth innings, which shouldn't have been happening. One thing I looked it up late in the season. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember one of the names that was coming up during the winter, during spring training, was Zach Britton. Why won't the Mets get Zach Britton? Because Zach Britton doesn't have options. Nobody picked up Zach Britton. Just something that kind of floated through my mind from time to time. I don't know what the guy had left, why the Mets, after a while, didn't look at him. But then again, 29 other teams didn't look at him. You mentioned Starling Marte. There was something really invisible about Starling Marte this year, even when he was here, which was painful to watch because he was, I think we agreed, as valuable a player as they had in 2022. And I do believe the health was just not there. And I don't know if you pin that on somebody, it's just the way it went. And Brett Beatty, very much a Mets third baseman, and that most Mets third basemen are never the answer at third base. But that this was a first year test, so I'm not giving up on Brett Beatty or coronating Brett Beatty or Mark Vientos either for third base. So we'll see. And as far as no urgency where Buck Showalter was concerned, well, somebody thought there was urgency to get rid of him, and that they did. Buck's swan song was not quite like Buck's showstopper the year before. So thanks for taking us through that. I'm absolutely overjoyed that the calendar still says 2023. Next week, my goal, as we will not let our listeners forget the 2023 season, to kind of put it into instant historical perspective with the It Happens in Three series. So I hope you'll tune in for that. The stunning conclusion. The stunning part being that I'm doing this part of it. It happened. It happened in 2023. So you just heard all the fun stuff. We'll try to take a look from, if not 30,000 feet, then from, say, the top row of the promenade. And we'll see if we have anything to learn, because we're all about the education here. Thanks very much, Jeff.
I also made a lot of predictions in our final preseason show. So did Greg, but we'll talk about his picks next week. So I'm here to step up and show how wrong I was. Again, these are my preseason predictions. I said at that time that I was as optimistic as a Mets fan could be. And I also said, if you're not optimistic on opening day, when can you be optimistic? So I predicted the Mets to finish first in the National League East. That was wrong. I predicted the Mets to win 94 games. DraftKings had them at 91 and a half. I was a little off on that 94 there. I predicted the National League standings would go Mets, Braves, Phillies, Marlins, Washington. Well, I got Washington right, and I got the Braves, Phillies, and Marlins in the right order, not the right placement, of course. As far as how far the Mets will go, I said that the Mets will settle all family business. Oh boy. I said the Mets would get a bye, beat Philadelphia, and then beat San Diego to win the National League title, and then they would beat the Yankees in the World Series. So I was way off on both New York teams. So I'm 0 for 5 so far. I said that Pete would hit more than 38 and a half home runs, which was the DraftKings over and under. I got that right. I said that he would knock in more than 108.5 runs, and that was the DraftKings over and under, and I got that right also. I said that this year's Nick Plummer game would be named after Jalen Davis. Who's that? I don't remember. The Mets released him in July. My semi-bold prediction was that Jeff McNeil would steal 10 bases. He stole 10 bases. So I got that one right. But I also said that he would be the MLB leader in hits, and he had 158. So he just missed because Acuna was the leader with 217. And I asked for a bold prediction, and my bold prediction was that Ronnie Mauricio would hit 10 home runs for the Mets. He hit two, but I'll give myself partial credit for that because the Mets should have called him up earlier, and at least he hit two. So I did not do great with my predictions, but again, if you're not optimistic on opening day, you're never going to be optimistic.
Jalen Davis, we hardly knew ye.
Moving on, Joe Christopher passed away last week. He had 300 for the Mets, and anyone that wore a Mets uniform is worth remembering.
Yeah, let's remember Joe Christopher, New York Met, 1962 to 1965, died at 87 last week. I did not see Joe Christopher play baseball, but I've been reading about him on and off, as long as I can remember, whenever the subject of the early Mets comes up, and including reading what people who were in the stands at the Polo Grounds and in the stands at Shea Stadium and watched him on TV, and people who covered him. And I'm always taken by the fact that Joe Christopher, who is not an outsized name in New York Mets history, either in contemporary tellings or historical tellings, seems to stand out as that guy was my favorite player. Just somebody who the fans loved and somebody who loved the fans. Again, there wasn't a lot to love from a one-loss perspective in 1962 all the way to 1965, but there were also limited expectations. So fans may have been looking for something different when it came time to decide this is what I like about the Mets. And for a lot of people, Joe Christopher was what they liked about the Mets. Joe Christopher, the first player born and raised in the Virgin Islands to make it to what we used to call without qualification the major leagues. Of course, the Negro Leagues existed and players from all over played there. But Joe Christopher broke in with the Pirates in the late 50s, was a part of one of the great teams of the time, the 1960 Pirates, a legendary team. We think of Bill Mazeroski, who won that World Series with his home run to beat the Yankees. We think of Dick Groat, who won the MVP that year. And of course, we think of the great Roberto Clemente, a big part of that team. Roberto Clemente's roommate for road games in those days, Joe Christopher, both from the Caribbean, both talented players. And that's not just, putting a nice shine on somebody's career who wasn't Roberto Clemente. The Sporting News referred to Joe Christopher as perhaps the most talented player to come out of the Pirate system since Roberto Clemente. So that's pretty heady company. And it was certainly enough to tempt the New York Mets at the time that they had yet to play a game to draft Joe Christopher when he was made available. And they picked him, I believe it was sixth among all their expansion draft picks in October of 61. And he lined up to be one of the original Mets. Not quite original, at least by this person's reading, because he did not make the opening day roster. To me, that's the original Mets, but that's just bookkeeping and being a bit of a fuss budget on my part. Joe was up here by the third week in May. I think we may have brought this up after Frank Thomas passed away. Frank Thomas was acquired for a player to be named later from the Milwaukee Braves. That player turned out to be Gus Bell, which I've always found amusing because Gus Bell was played for like a month and a half with the Mets alongside Frank Thomas, but they finally sent Gus Bell to Milwaukee as if they'd forgotten. As they were leaving Milwaukee, ironically, in May, the Mets had just finished what would turn out to be their best run of the season. They had gone 12-10, and they decided to bring Joe Christopher up. Joe Christopher got here, and it pains me to say the Mets went out and lost 17 games in a row, but I don't want to give the impression that was on Joe Christopher. He joined the team. He started playing most days. He showed a little power, a little speed. Mets had three guys who were in double digits in stolen bases that year, the year where stolen bases sort of were taken out of the basement and brought back up for Major League Baseball to enjoy. Again, that's the year Maury Wills stole 104. Joe Christopher, stole, I think, 11 that year. But, again, that was part of his game. And Jeff, you mentioned that he batted 300. 64 is the year that Joe Christopher was a standout in the National League. 63, he was, again, a little up and down between AAA and the majors. Was part of the team that finished the Mets' stay at the Polo Ground. 64, he's in the lineup on the first Sunday at Shea Stadium. The first win for the Mets in Shea Stadium history, knocking in a couple of runs on behalf of Al Jackson, somebody he would room with as a Met, by the way. So, Christopher eventually becomes the everyday right fielder. And it is in right field where Joe Christopher at Shea Stadium becomes a legend for those who knew him and those who rooted for him. He had this thing with he liked to wiggle his ears or wriggle his ears or waggle his ears. It depends on who you hear from for the description. But he did something with the ears for the fans, made his cap move. People went crazy for that sort of thing in 1964. It was a more innocent time, but it occurs to me reading about the relationship the fans had to Joe Christopher and the imperfections of Joe Christopher, because honestly, Joe Christopher had some amazing games. He had one with a couple of triples, a double, and a home run during a week where the Mets let you forget that they were the Mets in 1964. But he wasn't much of a fielder, to be perfectly honest. Even his teammates at the time, Tracy Stallard, one of the stalwarts of the pitching staff at the time, complained to reporters, "Look, I can't think of another 300 hitter who hurts a ball club," because he had misplayed a ball and it cost Stallard a game in Chicago. But you know what? We've always kind of had a thing for players like that. Ron Swoboda would wind up succeeding him as the right fielder of the Mets. And Swoboda was that sort of God, he can hit the ball a country mile, but oh my God, and this is before 1969, a ball is coming his way. Watch out, everybody. Years later, Benny Agbayani had sort of that quality to him. DJ Stewart had a little bit of that quality to him this year. I'm just saying that there are certain guys. Jeremy Burnett comes to mind, kind of coming and going during his Met tenures. So I tend to think of Joe Christopher as sort of the forerunner to all that. But again, let us not undersell the 300 batting average. 300, it means something today, but in those days, batting average, being a champion of batting, if you will, was a huge deal. And players wanted to make sure if they were flirting with 300, they would get to 300. And on the final day of the year, in the final series of the year, when the Mets were in the middle of their very first pennant race in 1964, not as a direct participant, but as a potential spoiler, it was an incredible series. They go into St. Louis. This is the year the Phillies are blowing, long before the 2007 Mets ever came along, blowing an impossible lead to blow. I think it was, I want to say, 6.5 with 10 to go in the days of just one league, no divisions. And the Phillies went about blowing it, and the Cardinals came rushing on along with the Reds. The Mets went into St. Louis. Al Jackson beats Bob Gibson on a Friday night, which nobody could believe. 1-0. And the next day, the Mets stomp all over the Cardinals, 15-5. And the Cardinals really need to beat the 10th place Mets. And they fall behind early. And in the middle of all that, Joe Christopher knows what's at stake, and he lays down a bunt that Ken Boyer can't get to, and he beats it out, and he ensures that he's going to bat 300. So even though the Cardinals will come back, beat the Mets that day, and go on to win the pennant and win the World Series, Joe Christopher got what was coming to him. We talk about him today as a 300 hitter. The 1964 Mets, who lose 109 games, have two 300 hitters in their everyday lineup: Ron Hunt, who batted 303, and Joe Christopher, who batted 300. Probably for both of them, it was kind of the peak of their careers, although Hunts would go on a while longer. Christopher didn't have that many years left in the major league. 65, he sort of fell off and was traded when the year was over to the Red Sox for Eddie Brasseau, another Met who we remembered earlier this year. And really, the great game with the couple of triples and the I think 12 total bases and the 300 batting average, and then the business with the ears and the fans loving him. Those are all incredible things to remember for a player you may not remember firsthand, the fact that he has that legend to him. But this part, I can't get over. He writes a letter. He would write a letter every year to the general manager or the president of baseball operations, whatever the title was in those days, to George Weiss, who was not the most forthcoming and warm and fuzzy guy. But in those days, they'd mail you your contract and you were just supposed to send it back. And maybe to express your dissatisfaction, you'd take an extra few days, or maybe you'd negotiate through the mail, because God forbid you should use an agent. But Joe Christopher, if he didn't like his contract, would send a letter back, and he would send long letters. He wasn't publishing them anywhere, but I sort of feel him because it was a very blogger thing to do, to let George Weiss know just how he was feeling about the Mets and his place within them. And when it all came down to, we got news for you, you're being traded to Boston, he sends a letter to George Weiss and says, "The 4 years I did spend with the Mets organization were the four most glorious years I ever did spend in baseball. I want to thank you, Mr. Weiss, for having confidence in me. It made me have confidence in within myself." And then he ends the letter with a postscript: "P.S. It still hurts not to be a Met." That's what he said in 1965, and I would hope that for his sake, the hurt subsided, because he had a long life ahead of him. Had a lot of interests that he pursued. But the fact that somebody could, kind of be victim to a professional decision, which is what all of these are, it's a business, as they like to say, to just come right out and say, "It hurts not to be a Met anymore." To have been a Met when they were losing 100 games plus every single year. But nope, I don't want to say nobody cared, but people could deal with it. It's just, you were just happy to have the Mets. And happy to have Joe Christopher in right field. And George Vesey, guy we've spoken of a lot here, who covered the team in those days, got to know a lot of those players as people stayed in touch with them over the years. He wrote a really nice remembrance in the wake of Joe's passing, but he also wrote about him. It was in 2017. It was shortly after Joe had had a stroke and he was recovering, and he got back in touch with him. And at the time, George wrote, he was one of my favorite players in those first loopy years of the Mets. Someone who, talked of spirituality and art and would whisper to writers he trusted, "I'm a better ball player than you guys think I am." So the whole thing obviously meant a lot to Joe Christopher. And it just feels like we don't have enough guys like that in our lives sometimes, or maybe we don't recognize that we have guys like that in our lives as fans. So again, I never saw Joe Christopher play, but he said it hurt not to be a Met. To me, it feels great knowing he was a Met. And I hope we all appreciate the contributions to building a franchise that somebody like Joe Christopher made.
Beautiful words, Greg. Rest in peace, Joe Christopher. Our condolences to his friends and family. And that'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week with more. So until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
Nice hat, Jeff. I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go, Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. For tour dates and more, check them out on Bandcamp.